Good evening. My name is Jean Raymond. I'm the Vice Chair of the Health Commission, and I want to call the meeting to order. And the first order of business is the approval of the September 12th minutes. I was not at the meeting, so are there any corrections to the minutes as written? They stand as written. The next item on the agenda is public comment. Do we have anyone in the audience that would like to make a public comment? Okay. Could you announce your name and your business?
I'm Dr. Steve Hansen from the Central Coast Medical Association and the County Tobacco Control Coalition. I'm not here to speak about agenda item 5, but rather to tell you what else remains after this remarkable year in tobacco control, in which the age was raised to 21 for legality for both smoked and vaporized or volatilized tobacco, and that's been a very good thing. We've been trying for years to get colleges and both at the CSU level and at the community college level to be tobacco-free. The tobacco-free part is important versus smoke-free because it just it helps us combat the places where the tobacco companies are fleeing for new addicts. They're going for the, you know, the electric cigarettes and the kind of chewing tobacco that you don't have to spit. You can just swallow the stuff. And so people don't need that on their campuses either. Most people are actually surprised when you say that there are schools that don't have tobacco restrictions. Some 1,100 campuses nationwide. In some of the most active tobacco-producing states have already done this for the protection of their students. I'm here to ask you for your support, nothing in particular right now. We'll be talking tomorrow at our Tobacco Control Coalition for goals for this year, and that'll certainly be near the top of the list, and all the support we can get will help. There are still some faculty members and others who think that it's a good thing to smoke, but it helps everybody if you quit. Oops, it looks like I'm out of time. I won't go on any longer. Just about item 5, thanks for doing that. It needs to happen.
Thank you for your comments, Dr. Hansen. Okay, we'll be moving on. Are there any other public comments? Okay, we'll move on to the presentations. And I believe first on the list is Karen Jones. She's the Executive Director, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services for San Luis Obispo County. And she'll be talking about gaps in services for the elderly.
Thank you. Jean, if I could make a request about 15 minutes in, will you kind of give me some signal? Because I don't want to steal their time. And you know how I am with microphones. Like, I don't give them up. As Jean said, my name is Karen Jones. I'm with the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program here in San Luis Obispo County. I've been here just about 18 years. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what we do, for those of you not familiar, and then I'll talk more about what the topic is for tonight. So Ombudsman Services is a federal and state agency. We're part of the Federal Administration on Aging and part of the state California Department of Aging. And then here in San Luis County, we provide the local program. And we are a nonprofit that has the contracts. We write grants to gain the contracts to provide the service. And we've had that since 1978. Our mission is to promote the highest possible quality of life and care for all residents of long-term care facilities. And we take that very seriously. In fact, we all really love what we do. Our bad days are bad, but our good days are really awesome. So some of the things that we do are we advocate for residents, both individual and systemic. So if we see a system that's not working, a law that's not working, a regulation that's not working, we will do our best to correct that. Am I standing too close? This feels echoey. It's okay? All right. It's just me. I'll echo. We also do complaint investigation and resolution. We are very good at that. In San Luis County, we resolve 85% I guess I got lost. 95% of the complaints that we investigate, and that's a really good number. We don't actually have punitive power, so I can't force a care facility or a person to do something that they shouldn't do or should do, but without that punitive powers, we're still really good at talking people into doing the right thing. We also do information and referral, so people call us and ask for assistance in long-term care issues or just can the facilities do that. We do a lot of those every year. We do facility monitoring visits, and what that means is that we don't wait for a complaint or a concern to be called into us. We actually go out to the care facilities on a regular basis, 2 to 3 times a week in each nursing home and once or twice a month in each residential facility. And what we're looking for is health and safety issues. We're talking to the residents. We're talking to the staff, to the visitors. And we like to say we're trying to put out any fires before someone even pulls the match out of the box. If you see smoke, it's already a little too late. Someone has suffered a bit. So we really want to fix problems before they actually become a problem. In California, we also do advanced healthcare directive witnessing. So if somebody lives in a skilled nursing facility, an ombudsman is required by state law to be a witness on that document to make sure that the person who's signing it is not being coerced and that that's really what they want to do and that they appear to understand the document. And we do do almost 100 of those a year, so it's a pretty busy thing we do. And we also do community education sessions. So I do a lot of training. I'm doing a training next or later this week for Cal Poly for one of the classes. And we're pretty good at getting out to people to try to educate them because the sooner people know about long-term care, the better prepared they are. And in the handout I gave you guys, there's some actual statistics and some the list of care facilities that we serve. So now I'll kind of tell you more about what Chris, when she asked me to speak tonight, what she wanted me to talk about, which is the gaps in care here in San Luis County. And I wanted to start with telling you about some calls that we got just this month, actually in the last 2 weeks. And this is every day, but in particular these calls I wanted you to kind of understand. So one of the calls we got for information referral was a daughter calling about her dad. It was an adult daughter. And she said that her dad has dementia. He's falling. He's got a lot of significant health issues, including dialysis. And Adult Protective Services is already involved. Her dad needs placement and someone to monitor his finances. He doesn't have any assets, and he has limited income. That's a call we get all the time. And if that's not hard enough, the mom also is ill and disabled and really needs placement too, but the call was about specifically dad. I've also gotten a call this month about another daughter. Her dad was transferring from the hospital into a nursing home, and he has dementia, was living at home. He does not have any legal documents, no power of attorney, no health care directive, no trust, no will, nothing that would tell them what his assets are or where it's at. And with his dementia, he can't do those documents now. He also doesn't, as far as anyone knows, have the finances to pay for an attorney, and they really need to get conservatorship without an attorney, which is hard enough with an attorney, so it's going to be quite the challenge. I got another call from a gentleman whose brother was discharging from the nursing home that day. The brother was an alcoholic, kind of a career alcoholic and not doing very well, and had a lot of care issues. But his time in the nursing home was over. His Medicare was no longer going to cover his stay there, and they were trying to figure out what to do and where to place him. And while I was actually typing up my presentation today, I got a call from a lady whose mom is in the hospital down in Los Angeles area and needs placement in a nursing home here near her daughter. Daughter lives in San Luis County, and mom has a tracheotomy, which is that little tube in the throat. So she was kind of desperate to get mom less than 4 hours away, which is where she is now. So that's just a typical kind of a day in my office, and it's what people are dealing with out in the community. And what those callers expect when they call us, what they all think is out there, because this is usually the first time anyone's talked to them about that or they've reached out, they have in their heads this image of a safety net, that they're going to make this phone call and the heavens will open and services will fly out and they will get placement in a facility today and there will be a way to pay for that. And it will all work out seamlessly because no one talks about this. No one is even aware of how hard it can be. So they're expecting a safety net with services. They're expecting that they can afford to pay for this or that there's a way to pay for it. they all think that they, the government, somebody is going to solve this. And they also, my very favorite thing is when people go, well, I'm just going to give my mom to the state or to the county. I hear that a lot too. They're going to give mom to the county. And I have to tell people a lot, there isn't really a granny mobile where the state's going to come pick up your older persons and provide care for them somewhere. It truly doesn't exist. After I talk to them, trying not to depress them, most callers learn that there isn't a safety net. In fact, the last couple of years, I used to say, well, you know, the safety net due to the recession is kind of down to a piece of duct tape and a piece of baling twine. And if you shred them real carefully, you might have something. But I'd have to say in the last couple of years, it's down to either a piece of baling twine or a piece of duct tape, and neither one of them are in good shape anymore. So it's tough to find a good safety net. Even when you can find a free or low-cost service to help, there's often waiting lists. Well, how can somebody coming out of the hospital wait for the services that they need to be safe at home? It doesn't happen. And it can take hours to make phone calls to coordinate all these lack of services or what few you can find. So it can be really challenging, especially for the sandwich generation who's dealing with children at home, aging parents, and somehow trying to keep their job and make a lot of phone calls when they're supposed to be doing their work. It really affects their income if they're not careful. They also learn that there's just not enough care facilities. If you look on the list I gave you, we have 8 nursing homes in San Luis County, about 800 beds. They run between 95 and 98% occupied at any given time. There are huge waiting lists, years, and the waiting lists don't even move correctly. Like, you think, well, I'm on the waiting list, I'm number 2, I'm almost there, any day now they're going to call. No, because what happens is anybody already in the nursing home on Medicare for rehab therapy gets the first dibs on staying. And so you can be on the waiting list as number 1 or number 2 or number 3 for 9 months, 10 months, 2 years, 3 years. And you may still be number 1 or number 2, but you're not actually going to get into that nursing home. It's not here. Los Angeles County has about 80% occupancy rate, but then you have to live in Los Angeles. So for people, you know, most seniors, most disabled folks, like anyone else, their goal is to stay healthy and stay home. They don't plan to be broken, at least most of us don't. They don't plan for health problems that leave them a little bit less than able to take care of their own needs. And so there's kind of this thought process with the seniors, with their family members, that if they need help at home, it will happen. And the reality is home care, unless you qualify for Medi-Cal, and then you can qualify for in-home care services through the county, costs between $20 to $25 an hour, 24 hours. So if you need 24-hour care, it's the same rate all day long. In the past, you could get a less rate for a 24-hour rate, but with the overtime rules changing, now it's at $20 to $25 an hour all the time. In-home supportive services can be less, but there's still a substantial share of cost of what your income might be. And long-term care insurance may pay for that, but not every policy does, and not every policy pays for enough hours. And then there's also home health that can help people at home, which is nice, but it's not care. It's a nurse who comes in for a 20, 30-minute, one-hour visit to do nursing stuff. There's a caregiver who may come in to help you with a bath. And then there's therapy folks to do speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy. But they come in, do that service, and go. They don't stay and make you meals or help you with shopping. And typically, Medicare or Medi-Cal or private insurance will pay the majority of those costs. But it's not like you get a nurse that's going to stay with you all day long. For seniors or disabled folks who have to move into a care facility because care at home is inadequate or they don't have a home to do that, there are residential care facilities for the elderly. That's the blue list that I handed out. There are about 100 of those facilities in this county. They range in size from 4 beds to 160 beds. And there's about 1,100 of those facility beds, or 1,300 now, of care facility beds in that type. Those facilities cannot give nursing care. So if you're diabetic or have need a lot of nursing care, if you need injections of any kind or can't actually put your own medicine in your own mouth, you're really not supposed to be in those facilities. They're more for day-to-day caregiving and meals and medication management. The cost of those facilities is $2,000 to $7,000 a month, and it's really hard to find a $2,000 care facility in this area. You know, our housing costs are high, and that rolls down to everything that affects seniors and disabled folks. Typically, that's going to be paid out of pocket with your savings or your income. Long-term care insurance may be an option if you have that, and it depends on the policy. And then some people do get VA benefits, but if you have not already applied for VA aid and attendance benefits, it can take a year or more to get that approved. And that's a very long time to wait for the care you might need. Health insurance, Medicare, and Medi-Cal do not pay for that type of care in our community. And there is an ability to use SSI, which is Supplemental Social Security. There, you can get an increase in that rate to pay for residential care, but it only increases it to $1,100 a month, and the care facilities start at $2,000. It's not going to, you know, there's three or four facilities that will take two or three people in the whole community for all of San Luis County, and nobody in San Luis or Santa Barbara County does that either. There's just none of those facilities here. There's also the skilled nursing facilities. Again, we have eight of those. Seven are long-term. Many of you know that six of them are owned by one company here in San Luis County, which can make for a bit of a monopoly problem. If you are a problem in one of their facilities, it may be harder to get into one of their other facilities. So it doesn't happen all the time, but it is a concern. There's about 800 of those beds, and again, there's a very long waiting list. You can pay for a skilled nursing facility with either Medicare, if you've been in the hospital for 3 days, and they'll pay for part of your stay for the first 20 days and up to 100 days. It is hard to get 100 days with Medicare paying for that. They kind of say, well, why do you need 100 days? Why not 98 or 20 or whatever? So it can be challenging to stay in a nursing home on Medicare. Some health insurance will also cover the rehab time. And the rest of the time would be staying long-term in a nursing home, and that can cost out-of-pocket anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000 a month, or long-term care insurance may pay for it, or the biggest provider is going to be Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal pays the majority of the long-term care costs, and they pay about $5,500 a month. The person in the facility has what's called a share of cost, and that share of cost is their entire income minus $35. If they have a spouse or a partner at home, they may be able to keep some of the income. But if they're a single person, all but that $35, which is we jokingly refer to as, really, what are you going to do with $35? It's called a personal needs allowance. Probably meant a lot 50 years ago. Right now, it doesn't really pay your cell phone bill. So it needs to be increased significantly. There's also some challenges right now with some changes in how the classifications are being made with SenCal. SenCal is the community-based Medicare or Medi-Cal managed care. They're currently, for some of the more able-bodied residents in nursing homes, are re-looking at those folks and determining that they don't qualify to stay. The problem with those residents is that they've been in the nursing homes for anywhere from 6 months to 5 years. They do not have a home in the community. They're low income, no asset, no family to stay with, and there's nowhere for them to go. And we're doing our very best to keep them out of homelessness and out of and staying in the county because that's not an appropriate discharge. So that's creating a little bit of a challenge for some of the more able-bodied folks in the nursing homes. One of the things that we're looking at to help with this is the need for care management. You know, if you're an 80-year-old person and your spouse is also in their 80s and you both have some health issues and one of you has dementia, it's really hard to spend hours on the phone coordinating care, to finding placement, to getting the services you need in the home to be as healthy as possible. And I would have to say it's really important to have someone who can help you do that if you don't have family. And we do not currently have low or no-cost case management services, which would provide someone to make those calls, to coordinate those services, to explain the process, because it's very confusing. And the Adult Services Policy Council, like you, it's a commission that is a board for the or a body for the Board of Supervisors, is currently looking at some options for bringing in free or low-cost care management. But that is something we'll be looking for a lot of partners. We really need that to happen. Is it my time? Okay. I wanted to mention really quickly, since that was my time, some of the alternatives that we do tell people. And one of those is to move out of the area. Some areas have more options, L.A. If somebody's lucky enough to have a family member in Oregon, they have some amazing services up there for seniors. You know, they may be able to have someone help offset the cost, help pay in towards the cost of care, and they may be able to move in with family. But those are not great options. We shouldn't be recommending people find somewhere to move to away from here. That's odd. You know, people who helped build our community and now we're saying, hey, go to Oregon or, you know, get out of the county. That's terrible advice. And I wanted to mention before I end and ask for any questions, some of the things that we've looked at for help with this. So, of course, the first one is free or low-cost case management, care management. It's vitally important we get that back into this community to help with this. Some systemic things that we can do is to work with the federal government, to increase the SSI payments to residential care facilities. If we could get that bumped up to $2,000, we could get a lot more seniors and disabled people placed into residential care. Also, in some parts of the state, Medi-Cal will pay for residential care facilities. That's a Medi-Cal waiver program. We need that here. We desperately need that here. I'd also really love to see the Oregon Foster Care Program. They have an adult foster care program in Oregon. It's like residential care light. One or two people living in someone's family home with some licensing regulations and oversight, but not so much that it's prohibitive to provide that. And so you get more people into the services that they need with the supervision and help that they need. And of course, we all know we need a lot more low-cost senior housing out in the community, apartments or whatever that's going to be. We also need more nursing home beds. Nobody's building your normal kind of nursing home in this area, and we haven't had any for many years. We need those beds. We're going to need them as our population ages. And I'd also like to point out something I'm sure you're aware of, the Health Commission. We need more doctors. We do not have enough doctors for the people we have in this community already, and that's not going to change. But if we had more doctors, people could get into their appointments sooner, they could get the help they need sooner, and they would be healthier longer. And that's really the key, is trying to keep people from needing a nursing home or needing a care facility. That's really all of our dreams. Nobody wakes up in the morning and goes, I'm so happy I get to move to a nursing home today. My life is complete. It's just not something that people say. And there's a reason for that. So anyway, thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, I'll happily answer those or I'll pass it over to the next group.
Thank you, Karen. It's, you always come with such vital information that's really important to our community. I noticed on your blue sheet you have lots of labeling like dementia care, respite care available, and so on. Any particular reason we don't have Medi-Cal facilities labeled here?
They're all Medi-Cal facilities.
Oh, so each one would be.
Yeah.
Okay.
The only issue is that San Luis Transitional Care, the one with 23 beds, they don't do long-term care. So they can take Medi-Cal, but they only do rehab, and then you need to find somewhere else to stay. You can't stay there long-term.
Okay. Well, I hear a lot of need in the community in your message that, you know, things like SSI, trying to get that bumped up, that sort of thing. Do you have an advisory group or anything, a board of directors or something that, you know, tries to take on some of these initiatives?
I do have a board. Actually, Jean's on my board, and so is Chris Kington Barker. So I've got your group stacked, although Chris is on vacation right now. They do take on some of the issues. We also are part of the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman Association, and we're part of the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Association. So we're very involved in systemic advocacy. I am a firm believer in fixing a system once instead of a problem 1,000 times.
Very good. And make a pitch for volunteers. What kind of volunteers do you need currently?
We are planning a volunteer training class in early January, sometimes start in January, and our ombudsmen go out to the care facilities. They act as full ombudsmen. The training is about 40 hours, and what we are looking for is dedicated people who have a passion for what we're doing, and I'm happy to answer any questions for anyone who wants to know more about that. We do have a website. It's ombudsmanslo.org, and you can get some more information about volunteering there.
I see you have a statistic on volunteers here. Average number of years served in the range. You've got someone who's been doing this for 25 years?
Yes, that's Rita Mertens. And Rita is partially retired now, which is terribly rude of her. I mean, 25 years, I don't know what she's thinking. She's been with us for quite some time. She kind of does backup now when somebody else is not available.
Great.
And typically, ombudsmen in San Luis County stay unless some big life change happens. In the state, it's 1 or 2 years, but for our program, we're really fortunate to have a really solid base of people who don't leave us, which makes a big difference in their abilities. Not that volunteers aren't allowed to leave eventually. You don't want to scare people off going, I can't volunteer there. I have to stay 25 years. But I mean, it's nice, but it's not required.
Well, thank you very much for what you do in our community and for your office.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Nope. You know, our responsibility is to advise and recommend to the Board of Supervisors. If there is one, can you suggest one thing that might be achievable that we could do for you in that way?
My hopes and dreams right now are really tied up in getting free and low-cost case management. I think that's just going to solve so many problems. We have law enforcement officers spending half of their duty, their shifts, 12-hour shifts, working with one family because, you know, of dementia, and the person's combative and running away, and that's so inappropriate. I mean, if we only have a limited number of deputies out in the community, let's get them doing their deputy work and a case manager keeping that family from getting to that crisis. I don't mind helping in a crisis, but crisis is horrible. That means things have really hit the fan, and let's try to stop it before we get there and make it a much more positive thing. So that's where my hopes and dreams are right now, is if we could do anything, it's let's get some funding for case management here in this community. It will change the game for everyone.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here and your tenacity for staying in this job. I really appreciate what you do and have watched you over the years. And, you know, being in the working in this field all this time, it's like over the years we've had a few good conferences that's talked about the senior issues in this county. And it just seems like right now we're hitting an area here where we don't have enough housing. We don't have the senior housing. We've got homeless that are winding up in these care facilities because they can't just be taken to the ER and then pushed out the door back into the streets. And that's using more beds. I got to witness a lot of this summer because of the illness of someone close to me, and spent quite a bit of time in and out of one of the residential facilities besides the hospitals. And it's not a pretty picture. And it just seems to me that, you know, when we've got other models out there, like in Oregon and some of these other issues coming up, that we need to get our policymakers and everybody together. Is there a body at this point that might look at going, let's all get around the table together and see what we can do to come up with some solutions? Because we've been piecemealing this for years, and it just feels like we're on the edge of a really scary place.
You know, I'd spent a lot of time in Sacramento, and I would say that Assemblymember Brown, she's up for re-election this year, so if she prevails in her election, she's been the chair of the Assembly Aging and Long-Term Care Committee. I don't know who's going to be the Senate side Aging and Long-Term Care Committee, but they're very interested in these issues also, but they're kind of a quiet voice, so you have to really get to everyone because they're dealing with water and everything that they deal with at the state level. So making sure people are really listening to this message that this, you know, everyone sort of talks about the senior tsunami or the silver tsunami coming through, and we've all been talking about it for years, but we don't seem to realize we're on that wave. You know, what a cute, catchy title, but we have a reality problem. And the reality is here, and the services aren't. And so, yes, it's devastating to watch someone go through this horrible cycle that just leads to more and more health decline and really no benefit to anybody. So I don't know of anyone specific here. The Adult Services Policy Council is talking about these issues. The Commission on Aging is talking about these issues. But what we really need to do is look at what is the true cost and what are we spending as a nation now, and is there a better way to redistribute that works better, or do we just plain need more money? You know, is this really a problem you can throw money at? I think it is, but I also know that money is limited and we have to sometimes work in the political system we're in. I would say also Senator Monning and Assemblymember Asajian have both been very good at dealing with senior issues. Senator Monning really is passionate about seniors and their issues, and I don't think I think he'll be reelected, and we'll probably be able to use his services some more too. Okay. Thank you.
The next speakers, we have two speakers on elder orphans, a growing population, and Deborah Bayless, a certified geriatric care manager. Age Alliance will be our first speaker. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jean. And once again, if you wouldn't mind watching the clock and giving me a high sign about 15 minutes in. And thank you to Karen Jones, who is constantly an inspiration to this community. Let's see. Are we on here? Huh. I've got a slide presentation. Just follow on with what Karen had been discussing. Okay, what we want to focus on today is a particular segment of the elder population which are lovingly referred to as elder orphans, and it's a growing population. So, you know, what are elder orphans anyway? They're often called solo agers or aging singletons, and I have a particular love in my heart for this particular population because I actually am one. I do have a 93-year-old father with his 91-year-old girlfriend, and they're wonderful, but after they go, I will, since I do not have children and I'm not married, the question then becomes, who's going to take care of me when I get older? So I will essentially be an elder orphan at that point. So elder orphans really have no spouse, companion, or adult children for emotional or financial support. And actually, this is a growing problem. In 1950, only 22% of Americans adults were single. And today, more than 50% of us are single, and one out of every seven adults lives alone. People who live alone make up more than a quarter of all U.S. households, a phenomenal amount, actually 28%, making them more common than any other domestic unit, including the nuclear family, believe it or not. So sociologist Eric Kleinberg said in 2012, they are in fact evidence of the biggest demographic shift since the baby boom. We are learning to go solo and crafting new ways of living in the process. So recently, the New York Times published a graph showing the percentage of adults who live alone by gender and age from the year 1850 to 2010, and you can see the spike in age 65 and older, and I've circled that on the slide for you. It's just tremendous. This is the silver tsunami that Karen referred to, and it's also referred to in the media, and all of us baby boomers who turn 60 at the rate of one every 10 seconds, the growth in that population is huge. So older populations most likely to become elder orphans are geographically isolated. They're usually immigrants or non-English speaking, could be LGBT, disabled, and the chronically ill. However, other stats that I have found that throughout the nation, a lot of people are just choosing to remain single once they divorce. And the chances of being single actually are higher with the more education that you have. So for adults 65 and older, estimates are that 29% of non-institutionalized elders live alone. And that equals about 13 million people nationwide. So close to 22% of the 65 and older are likely to become elder orphans. And so the median income for households headed by persons over 65 is less than $50,000. And the poverty rate for adults 65 and older is 9.1%. And that's up from 8.7% in 2011. So this is a growing problem. So the typical elder is surrounded by a large circle of people who they depend upon to provide practical, emotional, and financial support. And if you're lucky, you are an elder that belongs to this particular category. However, with elder orphans, you know, they have no close family available to help, but instead they have to rely on acquaintances, friends, and the health community for support. So I've crossed off those three populations, those three groups that were so useful to the typical elder, and you can see elder orphans then have to rely on friends, colleagues, acquaintances, and others, and then they also present a larger burden on doctors, caregivers, and other support systems. So anyway, why are the elders, orphans of concern to us here in SLO? For one thing, there's loneliness. Being an elder orphan can be quite lonely. Isolation can decrease life expectancy by 10 years, and it's as dangerous, believe it or not, as smoking 10 cigarettes a day. Social isolation increases the risk of also developing dementia and can more likely lead to the need for long-term care. People age 65 and older living alone are significantly more likely than others to experience loneliness, and 7 to 9% of them suffer from chronic loneliness. So this is a kind of a scary problem. And in SLO County, or actually, you know, just to sum this up, socially isolated seniors are, you know, just more reliant on the community. They're more concerned about aging in place. They don't want to leave. They want to stay in their own homes. They don't want to be placed. They're more likely to need help from community programs and services, just really building upon what Karen Jones has said. They're especially vulnerable to financial and emotional abuse. And, you know, they have no one to make decisions regarding their finances, health care, end-of-life care, and when they no longer do so. So this is a feeds right into exactly what it expands upon what Karen was saying. In SLO County, over 18% of our population is over the age of 65, and more than a quarter of all households are actually one-person households. So that leads to the next question, and that is, what impact will our aging population and those who fit into the category of elder orphans really have on our community services? Well, for one, as Karen was mentioning, the public guardian, more and more legal, you know, in care decisions will need to be made for solo and incompetent and incapacitated elders. With elder protective services, more protection will be needed for those who are more vulnerable to financial and emotional abuse. In healthcare, elder orphans are likely to be sicker and have more complex health problems, including cognitive decline and poor mental health. They're more likely to engage in unhealthy behaviors, including poor nutrition, inactivity, and smoking, and they're more likely to need long-term care. And as Karen mentioned, all of these facilities, these social services, are already straining to the max. They're completely overloaded. So anyway, what can we as SLO County do to address this problem? In terms of health care, we really need, as Karen said, to attract more board-certified geriatricians and geriatric nurse practitioners like Jean. Include the establishment of an elder-friendly medical facility with a senior-friendly designation through what's called NICHE, or the Nurses Improving Care for Health System Elders. I think also to consider implementing PACE, which is the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, for nursing home-eligible adults 55 and over. So this capitated managed care benefit for frail elderly, including frail elderly orphans, includes medical and social services that can be managed by a nonprofit or public agency. This is feeds right back into what Karen was saying. Next, we really should establish more adult day centers, which provide nursing services, assistance with medical management, activities, meals and snacks, exercise, and support groups. This would be a tremendous help. The next thing is to really take a look at our transportation. We have several options already, but while it seems that SLO County offers many options for low-cost, accessible transportation, in reality, The hours are limited. Most programs operate only in a single city, so the range of mileage is limited, the radius. So if you want to go up to Stanford, for example, you have to choose a different service, and it costs a lot more. And sharing means longer transit times, and the cost is limited, limits the use by our low-income households. And some in the nation are actually creating a service called Go-Go Grandma, which is kind of like Lyft or Uber for grandparents. So something to think about. Next thing to do is to really use technology to help, including making internet access much more affordable and accessible. I don't know about you, but charter cable internet access is hideously expensive. Maybe make some more workstations available at senior centers, make more county services available and accessible online, such as applications, payments, and information, and facilitating more in-home computer training. And the fastest growing population on Facebook, by the way, are adults over 55 and 65. They're coming onto Facebook and other services in droves. And in many cases, that's the only, via Skype, is the only communication that they'll have with their adult children living at a distance. So we really do need to increase that outreach a whole lot more technology-wise. We also need to, as Karen mentioned, support construction of more affordable housing and facilitate the creation of more granny pods and second units. And some of those are really, really creative. They actually can drop a granny pod right by a crane into your backyard, and it's completely outfitted already with medical equipment. They're called med cottages. So another thing really is to relax, adjust the zoning and permitting procedures for those, provide financing for low-income projects, pursue grants and public funding to construct and operate housing for the elderly, and support the Slow Villages project. I don't know if you're all familiar with Slow Village, part of the village-to-village network. Well, California is one of the few states that has several of these projects going on, and that's actually intentional village communities where the residents can go and have socialization, have computer classes, have a lot of these services that they need, all within a friendly village scenario. The next thing also I would say would be to support outreach to the elder orphan population by creating a slow elder befriending project with training and vetting of volunteers. Now, Ireland, believe it or not, has a initiative called Alone, and they have the entire population of Ireland goes through a befriending volunteer training where they're all vetted, background checked, and they train them how to go and actually befriend elders. And then also expanding community education about Area Agency on Aging resources. They do a tremendous job. And they, of course, are also in heavily in need of funds. But the Senior Connection program is fabulous. And then also there's Caring Callers and other support services given by some of the local hospice organizations. Another thing I would say would be to challenge the Cal Poly Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship to create a startup weekend dedicated strictly to adult or to elder entrepreneurial ventures, products, and applications. And I don't know if you've done that, but I myself have, since I am kind of a geek, and I also teach e-commerce at Cuesta, I've gone to one of these startup weekends, and they're fabulous. Within 54 hours, you've created a business. And if we could challenge our Cal Poly students to create a whole suite of elder applications and products, I think that would go a long way toward addressing this problem. Another thing would be to create a safe elder vendor network, which involves funding a stringent vetting process of vendors and service providers. So you could kind of think of this as like a Craigslist of elder services, only very, very vetted. And rather than going to somebody's strange garage sale, you actually have a whole list of vendors and services that are carefully screened and vetted, fingerprinted, checked to make sure that they aren't scammers. Because as we know, elders scams are really, really prevalent. And then finally, I would say we just need to turn San Luis Obispo County into the most elder-friendly town in the nation. We're known as the happiest place in the nation. Let's make SLO the most elder-friendly town in the nation. So thank you. Any questions?
I have one question about the OSHER program. Is that something that is still active? Do you know?
The OSHER Lifelong Learning Program?
Yes.
They are trying to reactivate it due to budget cutbacks. I know that at Cuesta there was quite a few community programs that were outreach to elders that were just flat out cut due to budget cuts. And I know Calipali also suffered cutbacks to their OSHER Lifelong Learning Program as well. I hope that we can get that back going definitely.
Because that nationally, that's one program that has worked very well, seniors helping seniors, they understand. And by having education as the basis for it, you know, they're reaching out to other community members. So maybe that's something we can focus on.
We really do need to refund that. I'm going to invite Linda Beck, who is an attorney who is, why don't you go to that microphone over there, who is... kind of retreading herself into patient advocacy, and she also does work as a long-term care ombudsman with Karen Jones, and I want to get her input as well. So I think your question, Jean, was about OSHER Lifelong Learning. We definitely need to get that going. I've talked with Matthew Green at Cuesta for the community programs. Matthew heads up that community program. And he has tried to put together some elder programs. I myself would love to be part of that. However, as an adjunct professor, I can only teach up to 10 units, 66.67% of my teaching load. So I unfortunately cannot contribute to that particular program because I'm already overstaffed. But I would really highly recommend. One of the things I've been trying to get Cuesta to do with, and if they could get the funding for this, would be to actually have a caregiver certification and training program that takes the basic CNA training and turns it into a full-blown caregiver training program underneath the nursing department so that the students learning caregiving are not just waiting for instructions as a CNA would from a nurse, but they learn to take initiative. Believe it or not, they learn to cook. You cannot believe how many of my clients have been served oatmeal with just hot water put on it, and that was it, and that was long cooking oatmeal. Or other, you know, equally weird stories with people that just don't know how to cook. So...
Are you ready to present, Linda?
Oh, sure. I actually was just going to supplement Deborah's comments on a couple of things. One is to encourage the commission and really the community to increase outreach and public awareness of the Area Agency on Aging. Whenever anyone asks me about, you know, where do I find transportation, how do I get home health for my parent, what have you, the first place I send them is the Area Agency on Aging, and almost all the time their answer is what? Because it's an enormous resource, it's there, but the word doesn't get out. So that is something that I would really encourage the community to do. The OSHER program is terrific. Again, that ties back to the need for transportation. How do you get people to the program? And also to the idea of technology infrastructure, where you want to make the information and the participation available to people who simply can't get to where the event is. Any other questions? Thank you.
Can you help me understand better what Age Alliance is doing? I read the buzzwords, care management, corporate elder care training.
Oh, okay, yes. I'm a certified geriatric care manager. I founded Age Alliance because I saw the need for care management in the community. It is a private pay organization, however, because they simply have not been able to, Medicare has not reimbursed care management yet. I would dearly love to jump on the bandwagon that Karen describes of offering low-cost or no-cost geriatric care management and bill-paying services to the community. It's a very vital, vital program. How we separate ourselves is I am part of the, or I'm certified with the Aging Life Care Association, which used to be called the National Association for Professional Geriatric Care Managers. So we, in order to become certified, you have to have an advanced degree. You have to be full-time for at least 2 years in geriatric care management under supervision, and then you take an exam to become certified by the National Association of Certified Care Managers. So that is a quality assurance piece that's put in place for very few of the geriatric care managers in the nation. And so Age Alliance, not only am I a professional private pay geriatric care manager, but then also with my teaching background, I use that to train corporations in elder care programs and then also engage in consulting. I also have completed the fiduciary management certificate through Cal State Fullerton. One day I will probably sit for that exam as well to get licensed. But one of the things, just to build on Linda's comment, one of the things that the Area Agency on Aging does is they have the Senior Connection Advisory Council, which I was a member of. And because of how confusing resources are and all of the different acronym soups, which you just identified there, I helped them develop a directory of designations and what they all mean. So there are some cases where people will call themselves Certified Senior Advisors, or CSA, and that basically is just a one-day marketing program to seniors, and at the end of a hefty fee, and end of the day and a hefty fee, they're now instant CSAs. And that's why I've put in place this designation document, which you can actually download from the Area Agency on Aging. It'll also talk about what exactly is demanded education-wise, CEU-wise, exam-wise, licensing-wise for all of those designations.
So one additional question there.
Yes.
Do long-term care insurance companies tap your services at all?
In some cases they can. It depends on the policy itself. And usually what they do, though, is they like to work through home care agencies for reimbursement. And then oftentimes home care agencies will then call me in to do an initial evaluation care plan. However, pretty much by law, they have to send an RN first to do a complete physical and evaluation health-wise for that to then be reimbursed. Any other questions?
Yes, thank you very much. This is really interesting. One of the questions I have is, since we are an advisory board and sometimes we can provide some kinds of support, what I'm thinking is, when you mentioned about trying to get Cuesta to offer this, what would you need from us? And could we get a letter to the Cuesta board, to the Board of Supervisors?
You know, that's a great question, Susan. I think, you know, it all boils down to money and getting a grant for it. I know that at one time Sacramento had a $25,000 grant specifically for caregiver training, and I surfaced that to the Cuesta powers that be, and at that time they were embroiled in so many other issues that that was kind of shoveled down to the bottom of the stack. I'm hoping that, those kind of grants are still available. I know that I have talked with Marcia Scott, who heads up the nursing program, and she thinks the idea is fabulous. I would love to see it. I know that many home care agencies won't pay for extra training because it comes off their profit margin. And so if there was a way to fund caregivers through a program that was of a higher caliber than nationwide, that would be fantastic. So, you know, because many times the caregivers have to pay for their own fingerprinting and their own this, that, and the other thing, and they're not willing to do it. And home care agencies will just do the bare minimum, but they really will not try to train the caregivers.
I know, and I have a lot of personal experience with this, having taken care of my mom and
yes.
and a lot of friends, and coming from Cambria, where we kind of have to create our own services because we're so isolated up there. But it gives us the opportunity to begin to look at those kinds of services, and I guess we could get started by, is the Area Agency on Aging the group that's kind of spearheading this, or to contact you?
That's a good question. Go ahead and contact me, and I will
okay.
I will try to get a hold of who the appropriate channels might be at Cuesta. And as I am a faculty member, maybe I can actually, you know, have a little bit of clout.
Have you worked with Cal Poly? Because when I first moved here, that was one of my thrusts, is knowing that these Academy of Lifelong Learning, all those kinds of things in other states work very well, because it's seniors helping seniors. And they had a program at Cal Poly. Do you know if it still exists?
That I don't know. My last knowledge was that...
We have someone in the community that can speak to that.
I think it's a legacy organization from what was Osher, and I think there's still an Osher in Santa Barbara, but this one talks about just random topics, and it's not a self-help organization at all, as far as I can tell.
So there you go. Yeah, I think it would be fabulous. I think that many of the clients that I have that use home caregivers love the older caregivers, that because they're more responsible, they're less flighty, they're usually know how to cook, they know basic skills, and they just have a whole different value system. The only drawback is that oftentimes the physical demands are kind of hard on them, especially when you're dealing with transferring and that sort of thing. So I would love, and there's certainly a lot of older adults here in the community that would love to have a new job, love to have a career path, and I think this would be great.
There is also a Seniors Helping Seniors program, I believe, through Deborah Valencia Laver at Cal Poly. She's been working on that project for a number of years.
Yeah, she's the professor of gerontology at Cal Poly. Very, very good person.
She'd be a key person to talk with.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I would definitely love to bring her in and put together a program.
Just one question. Do you know currently what the need is for just the elderly population as a whole versus the gap? So in terms of percentages and projections of where we are now and the number of elderly that are in need of services versus the level of need that's currently being met, and then projecting out in the next decade or so, how that will continue to grow. Do you have any sort of estimates around that in terms of, I'm just trying to get a sense of urgency,
sure.
And certainly understanding that there it is urgent, but
yes. Well, I think.
Actually, I can speak to that.
Okay, thanks.
The Agency on Aging actually has all those systems.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I can go there and look to see what is available for our county as well as Santa Barbara, because our Area Agency on Aging. Our supervisor supervisors know both the data. It's where that we can make a plan
in the community.
And Joyce Ellen Lippman, who of course runs the Area Agency on Aging here, is phenomenal. And she needs a raise. I don't know if you... Anyway, she would. I think she would be an excellent person to also call upon for this for the data.
Since there are no other questions, I think we want to thank you so much for coming and speaking to our concerns. And if there's any way that we can be of help, let us know if we can write letters of recommendation.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is... Commissioner Klaus is going to be speaking about the considerations for our Health Commission to support Proposition Number 56, the cigarette tax. I believe it's an action item.
Yeah, I am a member of the Tobacco Control Coalition, along with Dr. Steve Hansen, who talked to us earlier. And I was asked by Dr. Hansen to have the board consider supporting Prop 56, and I did write a draft letter and I sent it to everyone several weeks ago, and perhaps I should just read the letter so everyone is familiar with what we're going to do. And if it's approved by the commission tonight, then the chair will sign it and we'll send it to the Tribune tomorrow or whenever Gene can get it there. So the letter says, the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission, we urge Californians to vote yes on 56 for public health. Cigarettes and other tobacco products cost Californians $3.5 billion annually to treat people from tobacco-related diseases like cancer and emphysema. Tobacco is the single biggest cause of preventable deaths in the state. Research has shown that higher tobacco costs prevent young people from picking up the deadly smoking habit. The Children's Partnership wrote, "The rise in the use of cigarettes among teens is reversing the progress made over the past 50 years in reducing smoking among youth. A yes on 56 will make California a leader in protecting our youth, investing in their future, and saving lives. The bulk of the money generated from this initiative, as much as $1 billion to $1.4 billion a year, would be earmarked for Medi-Cal, the state program that provides health care for 13 million people. A smaller amount, $100 million to $130 million, would be used to combat tobacco use. The Health Commission is proud to stand with the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association, and the entire Save Lives California Coalition supporting this life-saving measure."
Do we have any discussion about this proposal, this letter? I believe that we can take a vote to see if people are in support of this recommendation. All those in favor?
I think we need a motion.
Okay. Who wants to move this?
I move we accept the letter as presented.
And I'll second that.
I guess now we can take the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 I guess we have a unanimous decision. So moved. The next item on the agenda is Dr. Bornstein's public health report.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Just a few items of note. One was I wanted to follow back with you all. I don't know if it was last meeting or the meeting before that we had a couple of public speakers on the issue of getting quicker and comprehensive information to those in the Surf Riders Association and the public in general. And we being the Environmental Health Services Division director and other staff, have met with the people who came and spoke to us and are working on a plan for doing exactly what they had requested, specifically around making available annual data and trend data so that the public can see where the hot spots are over time. So I want to report back to you on that. Some of you may have seen a newspaper notice or heard it on the news otherwise that we have now joined 30 other counties who have had at least one case of the Zika virus. It is not at all unexpected, and it was the infection was obtained in Mexico, so we do not think that there is any local risk for transmission. We have been doing mosquito surveillance and have yet to identify any of the mosquito species that carry the Zika virus, but it is a good reminder to the public that if especially pregnant women, but or partners of pregnant women, or anyone who wants to know where the Zika virus is, it is in quite a few countries in the Southern Hemisphere and our South America and the Americas, and so folks can get that information by going to CDC's website and looking at a map of which countries are spreading the Zika virus at present. It includes U.S. territories of Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico have been hit pretty hard. We also, within 24 hours of that, identified in our own laboratory the first case of flu. Influenza. It is seemingly hitting early this year. A number of states have already had cases of influenza. This particular case was that of an H3A virus, which in past years has proven to be particularly more severe than some of the other strains that we have seen. So on that note, I just want to remind folks, all of you, if you haven't gotten your flu shots, we have a fabulous opportunity coming up on Sunday. This coming Sunday, October 23rd, the county, led by the Public Health Department Emergency Preparedness, is hoping to get well over 1,000 or 2,000 people in a three-hour period to vaccinate. The main purpose of that is to test our ability to deal with surge should we need to have large clinics set up, but also it provides an opportunity for a free flu vaccination for a large portion of our population. So Sunday, October 23rd, from 10 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon at both the Colony Park Community Center in Tascadero and in AG at the Women's Club. And you can go on the Public Health Services website to see exact location information as needed. I'm full of announcements tonight. So one more is that November 1st begins the open enrollment period for Covered California. For those who are not making any changes in their plans, they can continue to pay their premiums or their subsidized premiums and keep the health plan that they have. For those who are looking to change, who have used the state's benefit exchange in the past, the time to do that is from November 1st through January 31st of next year.
And I have a quick question while you're talking. Are there going to be any rate changes? I know that there was a concern that with Covered California, maybe some of the insurance companies are opting out or not upping costs.
Not that I'm aware of, but if I hear otherwise and I'm out of the loop, I will certainly let you know. But as far as I know, the plan options for this county are going to remain the same. And then lastly, we are having our quarterly meeting of the Opioid Safety Coalition. That's happening this Thursday at Sierra Vista in their auditorium at the hospital from 8:30 to 10:30. This is the effort of a whole lot of people growing all the time, which is great to see the energy and the number and types of people who have been coming together to participate in addressing the opioid epidemic in our county. So I welcome all of you and anyone who may be listening to please join us. We will be presenting the work of the various action teams that have been working over recent months, data committee, community engagement, medication-assisted therapy, naloxone overdose treatment, and I think there's one more I'm forgetting. Oh, the physician safety practices committee.
When is that?
It is this Thursday, 8:30 in the morning at Sierra Vista's auditorium.
Who can attend? Is it an invitation?
Anyone can attend. Anyone who would like to be part of our collective effort at addressing this epidemic. So, thanks.
Anybody have any questions, Dr. Bernstein? The next item on the agenda is the Health Commissioner updates. You want to start down? Let me start this in, Susan.
Okay. The Homeless Services Oversight Housing Committee will be meeting tomorrow afternoon, but I would like to bring attention to the Board of Supervisors meeting tomorrow morning, where there will be a public hearing for the 2016-17 action plan on the HUD projects for homeless housing funds, the CDBG and HUD and or HUD's funds, CDBG and emergency services grant, and how the planning department is looking to spend that money over the next year, and what kinds of projects they're looking at doing. And so they will be accepting public input for that public hearing before they put together their final plan. So any audience members that would like to watch, they can watch that on Charter 21, or they can show up at the board meeting tomorrow and present their ideas too.
No updates.
Well, I've been asked to draft a letter to the Board of Supervisors about the continuing and to date completely unabated dust problem arising from the Oceano Dunes and inundating parts of the Napomo Mesa. Those of us who've been working on it feel that we need more information to get a more impactful communication to the supervisors. And it appears that will mesh well with the difficulty we're having putting together a program for our November meeting. So we've tentatively invited Larry Allen to come talk to us about a couple of aspects of this. The big one is the modeling program that's being developed, I believe, by the state in conjunction with APCD. It turns out that that modeling will probably be used extensively to help modify the state parks very vague at this point proposed remedies. And we need to learn a lot more about that, how it will be used, who will be using it, who's committed to living with it, and so forth. And a second aspect of that is the way that the daily air pollution forecast is put together and distributed. And we think that might be improved so it reflects more accurately the intermittent very high peaks of pollution against a 24-hour background of not too much pollution.
So you're saying that Larry Ellen will be speaking about those two aspects, the modeling as well as the air pollution improvement?
He's been invited. We haven't heard back yet.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I have no report.
No updates.
Commissioner Scott Smith Koch and I recently completed our biannual review of the Agricultural Department. Our review included analyzing data from the Ag Department's 2015 annual report, the enforcement logs, the pesticide use enforcement work plan, and the pesticide regulatory activity reports. What we wanted to do was to compare the matrix from the current year's data to the prior three-year period, looking for percentage of changes between hours, numbers of inspections, and in some cases, the number of permits issued. We wanted to see if that reflected any significant changes in the emphasis by the department. We did find some negative trends in our review, primarily the pesticide use monitoring inspections. The total number of hours for this activity increased 23%, while the number of inspections remained about the same. Field worker safety inspections were down 32%. Pesticide control records inspections were down 24%. Structural pest control inspections varied significantly by the number of hours were increased significantly, while the inspections were only slightly increased. We were concerned because the staff turnover in the Ag Department was projected to be 40 to 50% between 2014 and going through 2017. We saw indications of this when we reviewed the things I just talked about having negative trends, and most of those negative trends were caused by the staff being understaffed and the training that they required to bring their staff up to speed. In our report to the Ag Commission, we did request comments on our observations regarding downward trends in metrics and how the department intended to address staff turnover going forward. We have not received any response from the Ag Commission to date. I wanted to say lastly that Commissioner Scott Smith Koch and I, conducting this review, had the opportunity to see firsthand how well the Department of Agriculture conducts a comprehensive program to protect the health and safety of its workers, the public, and the environment. And Scott, do you have any things you want to add?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. You heard a lot of negative trends in there, and I don't want you to come away with the feeling like, wow, what's going on in the Ag Department? They have a lot of positive trends also, and they are just challenged by the fact that there's this turnover that's occurring, if you will, the baby boomer effect maybe, that sort of thing. So they're doing a lot of training, and as you bring in a new biologist to become an Ag inspection employee, there's a learning curve. There's a good, 1 to 2 years for them to come up to speed, which bogs them down from being able to keep up the number of inspections at a high number. Or they're furthermore challenged by the fact that they are a very aggressive department in making sure that any applications of fumigants, which is common for strawberries, is definitely kept away from schools. And it's really impressive to see what our farmers are doing, the people applying those pesticides. They are choosing times when school is completely out of session. Some of them are at night. It's just really, I think, David and I were really impressed by what's going on there. And the farmers and the Ag Department are just practically hand in hand working very close and making sure our community is absolutely as safe as possible, because we're getting away from a very old chemical that was used. It's considered not good, to a newer one, and the farmers naturally want to make sure they still get the productivity results as desired. But the cooperation we received from that department, we visited with them several times, and is quite stellar. And they've got some very highly tenured individuals in their management, and some of those are looking at retirement or have retired, and they're phasing in new people before the other one's phased out. A little unusual in some settings, but boy, they're very good at that one. So thank you, David, for that recap on that.
Do you have any other information to share?
Yeah, and I have my own information update to give, which is, as Penny mentioned, we're coming up here on open enrollment time. Well, since I'm a Medicare counselor through HICAP, which is under the umbrella of Area Agency on Aging, this is our active time. Open enrollment has just occurred for Medicare. It's October 15th to December 7th. It's the only time that people who are currently Medicare beneficiaries can take one or both of the following actions, which is consider changing their Part D pharmacy plans. As I do want to make you aware that formulary lists have changed this year. Premiums, for the most part, are going up. So it's a nice opportunity where we can help people look at, is their current plan still going to work for them, or should they consider changing? The other option they have also is to consider changing from original Medicare as their provider of insurance to a Medicare HMO. Or if they're currently on a Medicare HMO, it's also their opportunity, if they wish, to move away from that. So if someone wants some guidance in being able to look at those issues, they certainly can contact the HICAP office at the Area Agency on Aging at area code 805-928-5663. And this Friday at 10 a.m., the San Luis Obispo County Commission, on Aging will be having a HICAP presentation to aid those who want to know more particulars about this subject, and they meet here in the San Luis Obispo Veterans Building.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda are the committee reports. Did the Budget Committee meet?
No.
Legislative? Now, community education?
No.
Nominating? I know that in the minutes I noticed that we do have an opening for a direct provider. Is that still correct? Is that something we advertise for? What's the...
We do. And we could probably send another notice out. I have received a little bit of interest, so hopefully we have a couple applications on their way.
And the next item on the agenda are the prospective future items. And I guess Larry Allen has been invited. Is that correct?
Correct.
Are there any other people that were going to be part of that presentation? Do you know, Jean?
I don't. We had Commissioner Grantham was working on a program, and the speakers were not available, so... Open to idea.
Yes. Are there any ideas from the other commissioners?
Well, I'm hoping we can impose on Dr. Borenstein next month to give us a summary of the known health effects of particulate matter pollution.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Especially, it makes sense if Mr. Allen's able to come that in conjunction with that presentation to provide an overview.
And if he's not able to come, what was the next month's presentation? Maybe we can switch them.
It was the planning meeting. But I can look at topics. I don't know when Chair Sage is coming back.
Yeah, were there any other items on that? I don't have that list with me, the things that we had thought about possibly entertaining for the next year or the next.
So I think we're going to try to organize some people to come from the Regional Opioid Safety Coalition in January. I can work on that for November if if people would like to see, since I'll be at the meeting on Thursday, so I can tap into some people there. Yeah.
That's a great idea. Are there any other items that we need to discuss as House Commissioners? I move to adjourn the meeting. So moved. Meeting's adjourned.